All right. Biblical view of drugs and alcohol. Here's our outline. First, we're going to look at drugs, and then we're going to look at alcohol. The reason for this is that alcohol could be classified as a drug, so a lot of what we learn in the drug section will transfer over when we start talking about alcohol. We look at a definition, biblical passages, build a systematic theology from those biblical passages, and then we're specifically going to talk about marijuana since that's kind of the hot topic in our culture of marijuana legalization. So.
Yeah, more like the pot topic.
I get it. Get
that pot. I'm so funny sometimes.
Every day.
It probably was not your joke.
What?
It probably was not your joke.
What
do
you mean?
Like you didn't come up with that.
I did, though.
So, definition of drugs. Any substance used to alter the state of mind, perception of reality, or physical performance when ingested or otherwise introduced to the body.
So ibuprofen is technically a drug?
Yes. Coffee is technically a drug.
That's how you smoke Vicodin?
Aloe vera cream is also technically a drug.
Yeah, so here's some examples. So the ones that you probably don't have to... Don't have to adjust your thinking on heroin, cocaine, Vicodin. Those are drugs that we all recognize. Heroin and cocaine would be illegal drugs that we all recognize. Vicodin would be one of those things that the doctor gives us. All of those are drugs. They're,
that's why they're called drugs.
Substances introduced to your body in order to change your perception of pain, your perception of reality, your state of mind, etc. Alcohol, aloe vera, steroids, coffee. These are all drugs. You had a comment.
I said that's why they're called like drugstores.
Exactly.
They don't actually sell like marijuana.
Yeah. Isn't the Greek of
some of
the one that was like pharmakia, so that's why it's like pharmacy.
Yeah. Pharmakia.
You just I knew you say
does that make chocolate technically a mild drug?
Yes. You could argue that any food is a type of drug.
Wait, why is chocolate? Why?
Because it alters your state.
So, like, if you're hungry and you eat food, you're not hungry anymore.
Correct.
But is it alters your state?
So, drinking water is also a drug because it alters you from dying to things.
Yeah.
Yes, but those are two things that you need.
Yeah.
You
know? Yeah. So there's the distinction. Say that again.
You actually need those things rather than something that you enjoy.
Okay. Yeah, and on top of that, every human being needs food to survive. Some human beings need specific other drugs to survive. Things like chemotherapy, right? You have cancer and you have a particular treatment that introduces a certain drug to your body that's needed to preserve life. So the question of the biblical view of drugs isn't as cut and dry like, so the government has these certain drugs that are illegal. We're supposed to obey the government, so Christians shouldn't do drugs. Because drugs, there are lots of legal drugs that Christians have to wrestle with of, is it right to use this or is it not? Did that track with everyone? Reframing the question to make sure we understand what ground we're on. We're not just talking about like heroin and cocaine. If that were the case, you'd just look at Romans 13, be subject to the governing authorities. The governing authorities say that those things are illegal, don't do them.
Cocaine used to be legal at one point in a certain way to help with like allergies. And
yeah, they put cocaine in a Coca-Cola.
They did do that.
And that's a big section of the marijuana topic because the legality of that is changing in so many places and the uses of it, medicinal versus recreational. We'll get to that. So with that definition of drugs in mind, any foreign substance introduced to the body to alter state of mind, physical performance, perception of reality, etc. Let's move on to looking at what the Bible says, what the Bible suggests. So, on your paper, you just have those verses with blank space underneath to write what was talked about with those verses. So, we're going to pass out some verses to read. Somebody want to take 1 Peter 4, 1 through 3?
I can. Can you say that again?
1 Peter 4, 1 through 3. It's on the screen.
Oh. Okay.
We're going in order.
1 Peter is after James.
I call Titus.
Whoa, 1 Peter and James are the same length.
Yeah, it's
a little bit better.
It's on our paper.
Yeah, it is on your paper also.
Nice.
Why would you do that?
I just like wiped some crumbs off this table, off the chair, and that happened. I was so confused. I went like that, and it fell.
1 Peter 5:8.
Those are some loud crumbs.
Everybody's going to be reading verses, so you might as well get over your aversion to reading out loud.
I have a Bible. I have 1 Peter.
Grab one.
Where is one?
You have one?
I have 1 Peter. Wait, is Josh doing
he's getting
1 Peter?
Thanks, Josh.
Yes, Josh.
Fine. I'll do 1 Peter.
So when I said you need a Bible at the beginning, it didn't click in your minds?
No.
I was looking to find one. Well, see, I thought to myself, I should get a Bible, but then I thought, I don't have one.
What's a good one?
So,
here is my sword.
You've been in the church. You've been in the church for 17 years, and you know how to be, right?
Have you seen that yet?
What, Luke Cage?
Yeah.
No. I'm rewatching Jessica Jones, and I'm going to...
1 Peter 5:8. Who's good? Jonathan, you got that?
Titus.
Oh, you got Titus? Okay, Jonathan, you got Titus. Who's got 1 Peter 5:8?
You got Luke? 5:8.
I take that back.
2 Timothy 4.
I'll do that one.
Why is it better?
Wait, 2 Timothy 4...
3 through 5.
3 through 5.
Galatians 5:22-23.
So
you got Galatians 5.
Is it
okay? You still looking for your phone? You got it. Okay.
No, but I still need a Bible.
You don't have a Bible on your phone.
I deleted everything off my phone, including. Did you get a Bible?
Here.
Oh, come on, dude.
You got a Bible
something
for me.
Something about yourself. Yeah, it's something
you got a Bible
me.
For me. Like, right after he was looking for his phone.
Yeah.
I was looking for my phone. Cause...
Quick side note. Josh, you're still playing. You're playing it, right? You got my text, right?
What?
The Romans 16:19. You got my text, right?
No, I've been slammed with school.
Yeah, grab all the ones you got.
But you, like, know it, though.
No, I don't. I've never done it.
All right. Before. Wait. Where?
Away if you don't.
We can just do Little Red Box.
Hey,
right.
Listen,
we can just do Little Red Box. Yeah, we can do that.
I'll take Matthew.
I think we should do
Steven
that.
Did
they get it?
No.
Hey, you can play Romans 16 on guitar, right?
Romans.
You can't?
You just had the full conversation.
What?
You just had that full conversation.
Yeah, well, I wasn't paying attention to it. I have two more hidden somewhere, but I'm not exactly sure where they are. They're probably
wait,
in places.
Wait, what do I don't even know what to click on for that.
Okay. All right, 1 Peter 4.
This one is now...
Go ahead and read it.
So
read it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Come on.
If I can... Okay. goodness, this is a malfunction. Wait. 4.
That's why you have a paper.
Wait a second.
Actually, even better.
Oh.
So, Peter is written generally to the church who is spread out. He's gotten past the addressing issues thing, and now he's kind of giving them the general encouragement things to do moving forward.
All right. Since, therefore, Christ suffered in the flesh, arm yourselves with the same way of thinking. For whoever has suffered in the flesh has ceased from sin, so as to live for the rest of the time in the flesh, no longer for human passion, but for the will of God. For the time that is past suffices for doing what the Gentiles want to do, living in sensuality, passions, drunkenness, orgies, drinking, parties, and lawless idolatry.
Particularly the phrase in there, no longer living for human passions, but for the will of God. And he lists some of the things that would fall into the human passions category, drunkenness, orgies, sexual immorality, sensualities, drinking parties, lawless idolatry. These are things that, if drugs cause you to do those things, they should not be taken. Check. 1 Peter 5:8.
Be alert and of a sober mind. Your enemy, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion looking for someone to devour.
A little bit further along, just another kind of proverbial phrase, be alert and of sober mind. You're going to hear that a few times. Being of sober mind is something that the New Testament calls Christians to. This plays into the question of taking drugs. Do these drugs alter your soberness of mind?
Well, considering being called sober means that you're not on drugs or alcohol.
Yeah, maybe.
That's a good hint.
Titus 2?
Oh, right. But speak thou the things which become sound doctrine, that the aged man be sober, grave, temperate, sound in faith, and charity, and patience. The aged woman likewise, that they be in behavior as becometh holiness. Not false accusers, not given to much wine, teachers of good things.
It's supposed to be 3, not 8. I just realized there's a typo there. But, okay. What's the advice that he gives in there that kind of falls in line with what Peter said?
Be sober, patient, sound in faith.
Yeah. Self-control, being reverent in behaviors, and walk and teach what is in accord with sound doctrine. Do what is good, not what is evil. And he seems to say that what is good is sober-minded, self-control, etc.
Thanks. Why does it say not given to too much wine versus sober? Is there a difference between the two?
Yes. Well, one is specifically referencing wine. So he's drawing a distinction between soberness of mind doesn't necessarily mean some external thing is causing the soberness of mind. You can just be irrational, being frenzied, not being patient and thinking, instead allowing yourself to fly off in an intemperate rage at slightest provocation. So sober-mindedness doesn't necessarily mean abstaining from something that would cause you to lose your sober-mindedness. It means you yourself, your sinful nature, wants to be irrational, wants to be not sober-minded. So.
Why is one different for the women than the men?
I don't know. I have to spend some time studying. But I can do that and find out. So let me make a note. My short answer would be because men and women are different, but...
Really?
Yeah. Crazy.
I hadn't noticed.
2 Timothy 4, 3 through 5?
For the time will come when men will not put up with sound doctrine. Instead, to suit their own desires, they will gather around them a great number of teachers to say what their itching ears want to hear. They will turn their ears away from the truth and turn aside to myths. No, and fine. But you keep your head in all situations, endure hardship, do the work of an evangelist, discharge all the duties of your ministry.
How did it translate the first part of that, verse 5? Read it again.
But you keep your head in all situations.
Keep your head in all situations. So some of your other translations will say, be sober-minded again. I like that, though. That's a good...
Keep your head.
And what's the context of that? He's talking about the future time. Some time is coming when what's going to happen? People will...
Oh, people will turn aside.
Yeah, they're not going to endure sound doctrine. They're going to be looking for their... whatever...
What they want to hear.
Yeah. Looking for something, wandering off into myths... So that having itching ears, they will accumulate teachers to suit their passions. Really describes the current church culture, in case you didn't notice. The word of faith, Joel Osteen kind of live your best life now. Jesus died so you could be rich. Prosperity gospel. These are people who are accumulating for themselves teachers to suit their passions, having itching ears, waiting for someone to come and scratch them. In contrast to that, you, he says to Timothy, endure sound doctrine. Teach what is in accord with sound doctrine. Be sober-minded. And endure suffering. Do the work of the evangelist. Fulfill the ministry. Recognizing that being a Christian is going to be tough. It's not going to be a walk in the park. Galatians 5, 22 and 23. Fruits of the Spirit.
When the Holy Spirit controls our lives, He will produce this kind of fruit in us: love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control.
What's the last one?
Self-control.
Self-control.
Here there is no conflict with the law.
Don't you have more self-control when you're under the influence of
people? Yeah, depends on which one.
Yeah.
What did he say, Joshua?
1 Timothy 5:23. This is going to be another one that's interesting when we get to alcohol, but what's 1 Timothy 5:23 say? Did I not pass that one out?
I have to move
to I'll do it.
Oh, you do? Mm-hmm. Well, then I'll do Timothy Bottles Baptism.
Rebuke not an elder, but entreat him as a father, and the younger men as brethren.
I think you're in 2 Timothy.
No, that's 1 Timothy 5:1, isn't it?
5:1.
Okay. Drink no longer water. Use a little wine for thy stomach's sake, and thine often infirmities.
Yeah. You have other translations there, instead of reading the KJV?
Yes.
Don't drink water.
NASB, ESV, those are great translations.
Basically, he says, stop drinking water and only drink wine.
That's what I said.
He said, stop drinking only water. Instead, take a little wine for your stomach ailments.
Be no longer a drinker of water, but use a little wine for thy stomach's sake. And that's basically the same thing in American Standard. Well, I can go to NLT, but...
Just go to ESV.
NLT's
go
all right.
Go to the one.
We can adjust where needed with the NLT.
Go to the...
Don't drink only water. You also drink a little wine for the sake of your stomach because you are sick so often.
Yeah. That's a pretty good translation.
So some wine helps.
Yeah, exactly. Paul actually instructs Timothy, drink a little bit of wine for medicinal purposes. You're sick so often, the wine helps you to sleep more restfully. So drink a little bit. It's an interesting passage when we're talking about alcohol. But Matthew 9:12, I think I had that one.
Oh.
But if you have it, go for it.
Oh, okay. I was trying to find it again. On hearing this, Jesus said, "It is not healthy who needs a doctor, but the sick. But go and learn what this means. I desire mercy, not sacrifice, for I have not come to call the righteous, but sinners." I feel like I said this.
So, this is just a little kind of an almost... an assumption, sort of a parallel thing that you can draw from the text. This isn't the main point of what Jesus was teaching. But he says, those who are healthy have no need of a doctor. But those who are sick have need of a doctor. So Jesus is implicitly saying that, yeah, when you're sick, you need a physician. Now, his ultimate purpose in saying that is, I am the great physician.
Right.
These people are sick with sin. I have the cure.
Is that when they're talking about how, like, he's spending more time with sinners.
Yeah. Correct.
One point.
Yeah, tax collectors and stuff.
And then he goes,
we talked about
yeah.
this at
the... Yeah, it's not the will of your doctor, but the sake.
Yeah.
Josh was right.
But yeah, he kind of makes that assumption there that those who are sick need a doctor. Like, everybody knows that. If you're sick, you go to a doctor. There's nothing wrong with that, is what he's saying. So, getting towards the idea of medicinal drug use, not necessarily wrong. Luke 10:34.
And came to him and bandaged up his wounds, poured oil and wine on them, and he put him on his own beast and brought him to an inn and took care of him.
Yeah, so this is in the middle of the Good Samaritan parable, right? He's telling a story. The Pharisee walks by, the Levite walks by, the Samaritan comes along, helps him, and what does he do? He bandages him, gives him the proper drugs to heal him, takes him off to the end, right? So in Jesus' parable, the good guy uses drugs. Now obviously, we're talking about
Samaritans.
Medicinal drugs.
He wasn't all
talking about medicinal drugs for the purpose of healing. Colossians 4:14. I've got it right here. If anybody else doesn't already, okay. This is where Paul is signing off in the book of Colossians. And it's just something that we know about Luke. Luke, the beloved physician, greets you also, as does Demas. He mentions Luke's a physician, and he's beloved. He's a healer. He uses drugs in order to
Luke
heal.
Was the one who...
who wrote Luke?
Yeah, but he was...
Sorry, what were you going to say?
Most cultures say this.
Okay, so this might be bad, but I'm basing this off of a movie called Peter and Paul.
I've
seen. Was in it.
Yeah, Luke was on Peter or was on Paul's missionary journey.
Yeah, I don't know
most
if that
likely.
Was in Acts as well, or if
it's true. Assumed because of the we passages in Acts. We're pretty darn sure Luke wrote Luke in Acts, and he's got three passages in Acts where he switches to the first person. We did this. We went and did this. So we assume he's there with Paul.
Gotcha.
Romans 13:1 and following. We actually covered this when we talked about government. It's the be subject to the governing authorities passage. You know that one? So.
Where did I read it?
Following.
Just one to what?
The
relevant
the book.
Context. Go 1 to 7.
Let everyone be subject to governing authorities, for there is no authority except that which God has established. The authorities that exist have been established by God. Consequently, whoever rebels against the authority is rebelling against what God has instituted, and those who do will bring judgment on themselves.
That's good. And until you do what is good instead of what is evil, because governing authorities are supposed to be telling you what is good. We talked about that when we talked about government. The point is, the government tells you something that is not contrary to God's will, his revealed specific will, then do it. So this factors into the discussion on drugs, because the government tells us these drugs you can use and these drugs you can't in lots of instances. And they give you parameters of when can you use these drugs, when can you not. So an example of that would be like Vicodin. Vicodin you're only allowed to use, according to the government, when it's prescribed to you by a doctor.
What is Vicodin?
It's a pain medication.
I have it.
Legally speaking, you're not supposed to use Vicodin when it's not prescribed to you by a doctor for some specific ailment. Kind of like when Paul's telling Timothy, take
is
a little
volume
wine.
Vicodin?
Sorry?
Is volume the same thing as Vicodin? Or is it two?
No idea.
What if you get nervous on
the ground? That's
okay. But yeah, so the governing authorities gives us rules for how to use drugs, not just which drugs to use. So those are some of the relevant biblical passages. I'm sure there's others that you guys can think through in your above average thinking minds and say, oh yeah, this would apply also.
How dare you assume my brain is above average?
What I'm hoping you'll do with these notes is that while we're talking through those passages, you just jot something down to remind you what is in that section. So when somebody asks you, oh, well, is it wrong to use drugs? You can pull this paper out and say, well, yeah, actually, in 2 Timothy 4, Paul actually encourages... The idea is you know not only do you know what the Bible says, you know where the Bible says it. That's the point of these handouts. Just a heads up. So now we're doing our systematic theology. You remember what systematic theology is?
Sort of.
Taking all the pieces and putting them together in a puzzle. So like, let's just put together some doctrines, some rules to follow, something like that, to help us understand what the Bible actually teaches. So our systematic theology, based on the passages we've seen, I've broken it down into two things. We've got medicinal drug use. There's plenty of passages in the Bible that suggest medicinal drug use as an accepted thing. The thing you have to remember, though, is something we didn't really talk about much in the biblical passages, but God is the ultimate healer. We mentioned this a little bit. Jesus is the great physician. Right? God is the one who ultimately controls healing, whether you use the drugs or not. He's the one who brings healing. He might use the drugs to bring the healing. He might do it miraculously without the drugs. But ultimately, he is sovereign over whether or not someone is healed or is not. Nobody dies because God was kind of like off his watch. Okay?
Oops, that guy died.
Yeah. Every single death that takes place, every single ailment and pain is ordained by God. And I know that's a tough concept for people to wrap their heads around, that God is sovereign over that. But he is. If you get healed, it's because God healed. Whether it was through means of medicine and doctors, or miraculously. So,
but he doesn't make the pain.
Correct.
He lets it happen.
Yeah, I would say he ordains it. And what, you could phrase that as he lets it happen. He allows it to occur.
Like how he did with Job.
Yeah. But the point is, God controls the effectiveness of healing in all situations. So, medicinal use of drugs, from aspirin to coffee to chemotherapy, all of these could be termed as medicinally using these drugs, is permissible as long as God's sovereignty in healing is recognized. Recognize that if you're going to this drug for help, you recognize that God is ultimately the one who allows the healing to occur, right? And I think we get a little bit caught up in our postmodern, or really modern, post-enlightenment thinking. And it says, oh yeah, if you're sick, you go to a doctor, you don't go to God. why would we pray for healing when we have these drugs to turn to? That is anti-Christian and dangerous thinking. You always recognize, yes, God has given these things, created these things, that they might be used medicinally. Yet, he is the ultimate healer. He is the one who controls whether or not the healing happens. So recognizing that in your medicinal drug use is necessary. Otherwise, you might be acting impetuously, as Paul would put it. Did that track?
Mm-hmm.
Medicinal drug use? What about recreational drug use? Things like having a cigar because it tastes good and it gives you a little bit, makes you a little bit relaxed at the end of the day. What about having a glass of wine? Things that are not necessarily wrong yet, but they're not for medicinal purposes. I would say that the Christian pursues self-control and sober-mindedness. We saw that in plenty of passages. So if your recreational drug use takes you away from self-control, sober-mindedness, it's wrong. Should not be used. However, recreational drug use that is not prohibited by law. So we'll get to marijuana in a second. But so like heroin, you can't use heroin recreationally, legally. So whether it takes you out of self-control and sober-mindedness doesn't matter because it's illegal. So that, there's another stricture.
It's illegal by the people who are put in authority by God.
Correct. But recreational drug use of, say, alcohol, tobacco, is legal for people over the ages of 21 and 18, respectively. So if you're recreationally using those and you pursue self-control and sober-mindedness in the midst of those things, then I would say it is permissible. Now, you need to do some self-examination and ask yourself, is my recreational use of these drugs, first of all, is it legal? Which most of you in here, it would be illegal for you to use any of those drugs anyway.
For sure.
Only for a few more months.
Only for a few more months. So when you hit 18 and you're asking yourself, am I going to use tobacco recreationally? Does it take you out of self-control and sober-mindedness? So example would be addiction to cigarettes. When you go without your drug of choice, does it cause you to lose self-control?
Well, isn't addiction in and of itself pretty much, you know, a sin?
Correct.
Yeah.
Because it causes you to lose self-control.
Right.
Takes you out of sober-mindedness. It causes you to idolize something over God.
Is it being addicted to that thing that isn't, I don't know, that isn't like permitted, I guess, by God? Is that the sin, or is the sin
being addicted in general?
The act of addiction. Okay, so it's either one.
I would say it's being addicted. The reason it's a sin is because you're putting something prior to God.
Because you need it.
Because you need it. That's a good way to put
it.
I need
it.
So, this would be my systematic theology of medicinal and recreational drug use for the Christian. Does that make sense? See how I got there? See how we read the text and then constructed rules to follow from the text?
It's like writing a paper.
Yeah. These probably aren't too revolutionary to you because you guys have grown up in mostly Christian homes, I think, that kind of taught these basic principles anyway. So it's like, oh, yeah, okay. But now you know where the Bible says it and how we got to those points. Particularly the question of marijuana. This is one that's changing in our culture. Some states are legalizing it. Okay, so then the whole thing of, okay, well, it's illegal, so we can't use it. Lists that layer. So then we go down to the second layer of does it change your sober-mindedness or self-control, right? According to the Bible. Does your marijuana use cause you to be unsober-minded, unself-controlled, or doesn't it? In the state of Texas, it's completely illegal in all uses, medicinal or recreational. So if you're still living in Texas, any age, doesn't matter. Marijuana is illegal, and so it is sinful for the Christian to participate. But if you're in Colorado, it's legal recreationally and medicinally. So what would be the rules then? If you're in Colorado over the age of 21, can you go smoke a joint as a Christian? Is that permissible? Is it sinful to do that or not?
In Colorado.
Yeah, let's assume that we're a 21-year-old.
Everything goes in Colorado.
Yes,
I think it depends on the situation, though, doesn't it?
Hmm.
No, it just depends if you're...
Well, you're not breaking any governmental rules when you're in Colorado, so you go with the recreational drug use.
Exactly. You'd say, does this cause me to be self-controlled and still open-minded? Does it cause me not to be? And
so,
there might be a range in there.
What if it makes you high to the point of you're not in full control of yourself?
Then it would be wrong.
So, like, what if one affects you that way?
Then not
then
even.
You don't do
then
that.
Don't even have one.
So, what if you really want?
So that's where we're going to get to alcohol, and then so with alcohol, there's a range of use before you hit drunkenness, which we're going to see a lot of pastors talk about drunkenness, the whole self control thing. Before you lose self control, there's an amount. So the government actually tries to put a number on that amount. So once you're over a certain ABV or what's the word. Blood alcohol percentage. Blood alcohol kind of things. Once you're over a certain amount, then you're drunk, according to them. The Christian would say, am I not sober-minded or not self-controlled by this? That's how I know I'm drunk. Another good thing that one of my professors gave me, this little, I guess I'll call it a diagram, this list of questions is really good when asking lots of these worldview questions. Is it right for me to do this as a Christian? Should I participate in this activity? Should I watch this movie? Should I listen to this music? Should I eat this food? Etc. Ask yourself these questions. Does this weaken my reason? Does it impair the tenderness of my conscience? When I do this, do I feel guilty? Does it obscure my sight of God? Do I start kind of losing focus on who he is? Do I start saying, yeah, maybe he would disapprove of this, but does it diminish my thirst for spiritual things? I notice when I'm watching, I'm kind of a TV junkie. If I get caught up watching TV, I'll watch like 6 episodes in a row.
Mm-hmm.
And I notice when I watch certain
shows,
which you're not, exactly. When I watch certain shows, it diminishes my thirst for spiritual things. The show Friends, I used to love. I watched it all the time. I realized when I watched those, I kind of got getting that mindset of ungodliness, of seediness, desiring things that are not spiritual. So that question really convicted me. I said, yeah, this diminishes my thirst for spiritual things. Does it increase the authority of my body over my mind? The whole sober-mindedness, self-control kind of a thing falls into that question. So you ask yourself those questions, and if you answer yes to any of them, abstain from that activity. I think that's a pretty good guide of how to respond to lots of things in our culture as a Christian. These aren't necessarily straight out of the Bible. This isn't like these answer all of the questions, but it's a good little general guideline.
Kind of lost.
Yeah.
So because marijuana could affect your reasoning, it would be wrong to take it even a little bit.
Correct.
Unless saying here, or is that saying anywhere?
Anywhere.
Anywhere. I mean, assuming that you're in a situation where it would be legal for you to do something, but would it be right?
Mm-hmm. So, well, see,
legality doesn't necessarily determine morality.
Mm-hmm.
You follow?
Yeah.
So just because something's legal to do doesn't mean it's good for you to do it.
Well, like my brother, I forgot what he says he has. It's like a sleep something or other.
Sleep apnea?
Yeah, I think so. Like insomnia or something, like those things. And so he, like, uses, because he lives in Washington, he uses marijuana to, like, calm himself and, like, go to sleep. Like, he uses it to help him go to sleep, and that's, like, it. And I was like, oh, cool, I guess that's how that works. And that he's like, well, I mean, it wasn't a thing, like, I wanted to do, like, I talked to the blah, 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 and that's what they said, like, it'd be a, like,
just be a help.
Fun way for you to,
yeah.
To help.
And I think that's legitimate. I actually think that it's reasonable for Christians to argue for medicinal marijuana use, so I would say, yeah, petition our government to allow medicinal marijuana use, because I know certain conditions are only helped by cannabis,
mm-hmm.
and there are ways to use it properly. I've seen where you roll it on the feet and absorb it through the skin, the vaporizer sort of thing where you breathe it in. It's actually used like a drug, as in a drug like a pharmaceutical drug.
As medicine.
As medicine, yeah. So that's where we go back to our systematic theology and say, medicinal drug use. Okay. Yeah. Does marijuana used medicinally would be permissible, assuming that these guidelines are recognized. Everybody pretty clear on drugs?
Mm-hmm.
I figured this would be, like I said, one that isn't too crazy for us. given the context we've gone after. Alcohol, on the other hand, so drugs is harder to build a biblical systematic theology because there's not as many passages specifically about drugs. But a smaller subset of drugs would be alcohol. Alcohol is a type of drug. It's a substance that you introduce in order to alter your state of mind. So how do we use alcohol properly as Christians? I don't know if this is luckily, but whether it's luckily or just a reality, alcohol's been around for a really long time. We see it in the Bible as early as Genesis 9. When Noah drinks it. He gets off the ark, plants some grapes, makes some wine, and then maybe sleeps with his son. We're not really sure. But
it wasn't him doing that.
I'm very confused.
Yeah, maybe his son comes in and does some stuff to him.
We're not quite sure.
We're not quite exactly sure. There's a euphemism used. So he gets drunk, passes out in his tent, Canaan comes in and does something, sees his father's nakedness is the euphemism that they use.
I thought it was just the fact that he saw that he was...
No, but then he gets punished.
Yeah, but then his Noah wakes up, and his brothers tell him what Canaan did, and he curses him. And we're kind of thinking something more than just went on.
Stumbling into the town accident.
Yeah. There's lots of stories in the Bible about alcohol use, and particularly about drunkenness. So here's a short list of quite a few of them. These are just the ones that I came up with off the top of my head. There's more than this. These are just ones that I could remember. There's Lot and his daughters. You guys remember that story?
Yes,
Genesis 19?
Yes.
So yeah, so Lot flees from Sodom and Gomorrah. His wife has been turned into a pillar of salt. Genesis 19, they're setting up shop in this cave, and Lot's two daughters say, "We don't have any sons. Let's get our dad drunk, and then he'll impregnate us, and we'll have sons." So that's where the nations of Moab and Ammon came from. Yeah. So we have incestual drunkenness relations.
Okay.
We got Genesis 29.
You didn't know that was in the Bible.
No, I don't.
There's also a character called Nimrod.
Oh, are you going to say I don't read that?
No, I was not going to say that. I'm not that keen to all the stories.
There's Genesis 29, Jacob, and when he marries Leah instead of Rachel. Remember that? So Jacob runs away after tricking his brother Esau out of getting his birthright. Goes off to live with his uncle Laban, works in the field, meets his cousin Rachel, decides he wants to marry her, so works for 7 years in order to marry her. And then the wedding night happens, and again, we get a euphemism. We don't necessarily know that there's alcohol involved, but he's drunk. Making merry and feasting, is what they say. And he wakes up in his tent and realizes, and behold, it was Leah, not Rachel. It actually says that. It actually says, behold, it was Leah.
What's up a tent?
That's where they
not
lived.
You know camping's always intense.
But yeah, so we're assuming, based on what we know about the marriage procedure, there was probably alcohol involved, and this is why he didn't realize he was marrying the wrong woman.
Wait, so him doing what he did with Leah was him, consummating it or whatever?
Yeah, most likely.
So, because that happened, it wasn't with Rachel anymore. Like, he was, not with Rachel anymore.
What happens is he says, "I want to marry Rachel," and Laban, his uncle, says, "Well, work for me for 7 years and you can marry her." Mm-hmm. He works the 7 years and has a wedding, and we assume from the context he gets a little bit drunk, a little bit out of himself, and Laban kind of tricked him into marrying Leah instead of Rachel, because Leah is the older daughter. It's customary to marry off the older daughter before the younger. So he marries Leah, he wakes up and behold, it's Leah. So yeah, we're assuming this is after they've consummated the marriage.
I wish Leah was here right now.
Oh, the marriages, the marriages weren't like how we have it now, where it's like, you know, you have the marriage and then you have those
reception.
It's like
so it was a reception,
and they may have had it in a different format.
Generally, yeah, what I know of the customs, and we don't know everything, but it was usually about a week long ceremony. We'll call it that. It's a celebration. The basics of marriage back then were the same. Your father gives his daughter away to a husband, and it's ordained before God. We see the first marriage in Genesis 2 when God gives away his daughter Eve to her husband Adam. That's why we do the whole
veil
giving away thing.
Too, like,
Yeah.
Even if you did see your
God. You make a vow before God to love and love this person until death do you part. That's what Adam does with Eve. Bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh.
Does this story have to do with Ruth, or is that a completely different...
That's different.
Totally different story.
So, this might be a weird question, but would that be considered rape? Like, because if you think it's someone else, and you...
Let's talk about that some other time.
Okay.
But
I was having this conversation
maybe.
With somebody else, and I was curious. This kind of
yeah, it was the question of can you rape within marriage was kind of related.
I mean, yeah, but he thought he was marrying somebody else, and so he was having sex with the person he married. So technically, biblically, it was okay for him to do that.
Yeah.
He was in the right mind, but Leah knew that she wasn't the person that
he meant to
that
marry.
He meant to. Right, and so it's kind of.
Oh,
but,
she wasn't. She wasn't along with it with Laban.
No,
I would say she was. I think she
no,
was.
Leah
knew that she was marrying Jacob. Jacob didn't know he was marrying Leah.
And she knew that he didn't want to marry her.
Oh, so you're.
He wanted to marry her younger sister.
Yeah.
All right.
And then he does marry her younger sister 7 years later.
Another 7 years.
Getting to polygamy. We talked about that when we talked about sex.
And, wait, and he has like
it's like
the 12 tribes from. Leah and Rachel, and then their two maidservants. The 12 tribes come from 4 different women. Another little fun thing to throw into the conversation of polygamy. God's chosen people, descendant from 4 different women and 1 man. You got Samson's mother. Samson's mom becomes pregnant with Samson, and an angel appears to her, tells her not to drink wine because her son's going to be a Nazarite. So. He instructs her to abstain for a specific reason.
A Nazarite?
What's that?
A Nazarite vow was something that is like you're agreeing to certain lifestyle, setting yourself apart. So Nazarites weren't allowed to touch dead things. They weren't allowed to drink wine, and they weren't allowed to cut their hair. Samson does all 3.
So it wasn't... Wait, so it wasn't weird to people...
That
he didn't cut his hair.
No, he's like, he knew that he had taken a Nazarite vow.
He's like, oh, that guy has long hair, and he's super strong. I wonder if they're connected.
Yeah, no.
Okay,
no, he has long hair because he's a Nazarite.
I always felt like I'd figure it out.
Wait, so...
Well, no, I mean, it does, because his power goes away when he cuts his hair. But... Absalom kills Amnon. So Absalom is David's son, one of David's sons. Amnon's another one of David's sons. Amnon rapes his half-sister Tamar.
And then the brother avenges her and kills
him. Yeah, Absalom comes along and says, you raped
David
my sister.
Tell him not to, though?
Yeah.
But they do it anyway. And Absalom got in trouble
Absalom
for that,
kills
right?
Yeah.
The guy anyway.
For killing his brother?
Yeah. Absalom, and the way Absalom kills his brother is he gets him drunk. He gets him drunk, and then he tells his second in command, when he's drunk, I'll tell you, strike him dead, and then you'll do it. Don't worry, though, because it's justified. And the guy's like, okay.
Because it's just okay.
Because it's justified. Because he raped my sister. Ahasuerus and Vashti. Esther 1, Ahasuerus is having this big party. He gets drunk, and he sends Vashti away, and he wakes up the next morning. He's like so distraught because he sent away his wife, and he's a Persian king, so he can't reverse that.
Why not?
This is part of the rules.
It's just how it works.
He's like, oh, I hate rules.
Same thing with Daniel in the lion's den.
He can't break his own rules.
Once he's made the decree, you can't. Not even the king can reverse it.
Yeah, isn't that like the story of Esther? I might be basing it off the movie as well, but like...
VeggieTales?
No. something, I don't remember.
That's why, I mean, that's why he doesn't bring back Vashti, because he can't.
I like the VeggieTales.
But the part where... like, he made a law that all Jewish people will
yes.
be taken down, and then he creates the other law. It's like they can fight back.
Correct. Yeah, he can't just reverse his law and say you're not allowed to attack Jews anymore.
Can he just, like, contradict the law by making another law?
Yeah, which is kind of what he did.
That's what he did. He like the Jews are going to get killed, but then he's like, but the Jews can fight back and, like, prepare and stuff.
Yeah, so the first law was like, yeah, anybody, you're allowed to go slaughter Jews. And they're not allowed to do anything about it. And then he made another law that said, okay, Jews, you can arm yourselves and fight back against the people who are going to come and try and kill you. And then that's where they get the Feast of Purim from. They celebrate what Esther did.
See, I would add another rule and be like, okay, so the Jews can fight back, and the people that are killing the Jews, you don't get any weapons.
Belshazzar loses the Babylonian Empire. Daniel 5. Belshazzar is king of Babylon, and he's having a party, getting all, you know, a little bit tipsy. And then he has a vision of the hand writing on the wall. Meno, meno,
te. Was it a hallucination, or was it a real thing?
It was a real thing.
Yeah.
But he's drunk when he does it, and that very night, the Persians come in and take Babylon by force.
And he's too drunk to find
out. We've also got the story of Jesus at the wedding at Cana, right? The first miracle. He turns water into wine. He's at the wedding. It's been going on a while. They run out of wine. And Jesus' mom says, "We've run out of wine." And he says, "Woman, woman, it is not yet my time." And she says, "Just do what he says."
Did he really say that?
He didn't say it like that.
Yes, he does.
It gets translated that way into English. It didn't mean the same.
Okay, because I know I heard that. I heard same that somewhere else. It was this guy like hopes, the password hopes to you.
Where is my super soup?
Where
is
soup?
This is about the greater good. I am the greatest good you will ever have.
This is an interesting one, though. So at the wedding at Cana, there's people drunk. There's people who are drinking for multiple days. They run out of wine, and Jesus provides them with more wine. Okay?
Mm-hmm. Because he's obeying
from
his
foot, from the foot juice.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah, juice. The foot juice.
But like,
no, it's washing water.
Supplying it for them to send me them more.
Yeah. So the question of it.
But like.
Yeah, so it's an interesting story to talk about, but we'll keep going. We've also got this passage in Matthew 11:19. So everybody turn there. Let me actually read this one. Instead of just me summarizing it for you.
10 pound of gold. Wait, what is the verse?
Matthew 11:19. So Matthew, or Jesus, is kind of going back and forth with the Pharisees, and they're getting onto his case like they often do. And in verse 19, he's talking to them. He's basically saying, you guys are a lost generation. You cannot recognize I'm the Messiah. And then start with verse 18. For John came neither eating nor drinking, and they, the Pharisees, said, he has a demon. Like, he's crazy. He's not eating or drinking. The Son of Man, I, Jesus, came eating and drinking, and they say, look at him, a glutton and a drunkard, a friend of tax collectors and sinners, yet wisdom is justified by her deeds. Some manuscripts would say children. So what's his point? He's saying, I can't please you, Pharisees. We can't win. John came here. He abstained from drinking alcohol. He didn't eat anything but locusts and honey. And you said, he's crazy. He's got a demon. I came here drinking alcohol, eating the feasts, and participating in these things, and you just called me a drunkard. Okay. So from the context, we understand that the Pharisees see that Jesus is drinking wine and hanging out with tax collectors and sinners, and they say he's drunk. Point from this is we have a clear admission, confirmation, that Jesus specifically says he drinks wine, and he drinks enough that people are accusing him of being drunk, even though he's not actually being drunk. But he's drinking alcoholic wine, is the point.
Jesus is?
Yeah. We've also got the Passover feast, the Final Supper, where he actually instructs his disciples, drink the cup of the Passover, which we know is wine.
Well, didn't they call it like new wine or something? Isn't that different or something like that?
You'll hear lots of arguments about it. Some people try and argue this wasn't alcoholic wine.
It was actually grape juice.
It was actually grape juice.
Because like new wine, because like wine is basically old
grape juice, fermented,
right?
Grape juice. Yeah.
So like new wine would be just grape juice.
Yeah, and I've done quite a bit of research on it, and no Jew thinks that they didn't drink alcoholic wine in the first century. Like, all the Jews who practice the Passover recognize, okay, no, they're drinking wine like we drink wine. And there's different types of wine that you're supposed to drink at different times in the Passover feast. You can read all about this stuff.
Was it a whole day thing, or was it like a multiple day thing?
The Passover?
Yeah.
Passover is one night, one meal. But the point is, Jesus specifically drinks alcoholic wine and instructs his disciples to drink alcoholic wine. Interesting story. Also something to note, all of these are stories, okay? They're descriptive text. See that word, descriptive text? They're telling you something that happened not necessarily telling you the moral of the story, what you're supposed to learn from it. It's not telling you how to react to what happened. You follow that point? That's important when you're interpreting the Bible. You have to know the difference between descriptive text and prescriptive text, instructions, where the Bible specifically tells you something or tells somebody something. You with me? So, we've also got prescriptive texts concerning alcohol. We're going to pass these out and read them. So, Proverbs 23:20-21.
I got it.
Josh. Leviticus 10:9. Other Josh. Proverbs 9:1-6. I'll read Proverbs 9, actually. 1 Timothy 5:23, we've already covered. That's the take a little wine for your stomach when you're sick, Timothy.
Take a little wine.
That's what I thought of.
1 Timothy 3:1-3 and Titus 2. We already read again, but you can read again. Just read the 1 Timothy 1. And then somebody want to cover 1 Corinthians 6:9-11?
I will do that.
All right.
10:9.
I'll cover Proverbs.
No, wait. And number 6?
No, just read Leviticus 10:9.
10:9. There it is.
So Proverbs 23.
Keep reading. Okay.
Proverbs 23:20-21.
23. Why am I on 9?
Because I kept saying 9.
You did, didn't you?
So I couldn't find it. It's like, where's 8 and then 7?
23:21.
Why was
be not among drunkards or among gluttonous eaters of meat, for the drunkard and the glutton will come to poverty, and slumber will clothe them with rags.
So Solomon is writing Proverbs, right? Words of wisdom, and he says, "Don't be drunk or gluttonous. Don't associate yourself with those people who are drunk and drunkards and gluttons." Because what's the reason he gives?
It's because the drunkard and the glutton will come to poverty, and slumber will flow them with rags.
They're ultimately killing themselves. They're going to come to poverty. They're wasting their money. Leviticus 10:9.
Yes.
See you later.
You and your sons are not to drink wine or other fermented drink whenever you go into the tent of meeting, or you will die.
So this is where underneath Leviticus 10:9. You'd write, the context is Aaron. This is specifically the Levites, the priests, what they're supposed to do. The Levites are not supposed to drink wine, period. But remember context. Who's he talking to? Who's being told? You and your sons. So.
And the lasting ordinance for the generations to come.
Exactly. The priesthood. We're supposed to abstain from wine entirely so that they wouldn't abuse it. I got Proverbs 9. Proverbs 9 is an interesting one. There's an ongoing metaphor in Proverbs. There's the woman of wisdom and the woman of folly. Okay? So, in Proverbs, in lots of chapters, we got this woman of wisdom who shows up. Wisdom shouts in the streets. That's chapter 2, I think, or chapter 1. But this wisdom woman, chapter 9, verses 1 through 6. Wisdom has built her house. She has hewn her 7 pillars. She has slaughtered her beasts. She has mixed her wine. She has also set her table. She has sent out her young women to call from the highest places in the town. Whoever the simple, let him turn in here. To him who lacks sense, she says, come, eat of my bread and drink of my wine that I have mixed. Leave your simple ways and live and walk in the way of insight. Wisdom is saying to, this, in this running metaphor, wisdom is calling out to these fools and saying, come, be wise. Eat with me, drink with me. Okay? Practice what is wise. Instead of what is folly. At the end of the chapter, the woman of folly shows up. The woman of folly, in contrast, is loud. She is seductive and knows nothing. She sits at the door of her house. She takes a seat in the highest places of the town, calling to those who pass by, who are going straight on their way. Whoever is simple, let him turn in here. And to him who lacks sense, she says, stolen water is sweet, and bread eaten in secret is pleasant. But he does not know that the dead are there, that her guests are in the depths of Sheol. So this woman of folly calling out to the fools and saying, come, turn in here, eat stolen water, drink stolen water, eat bread in secret places, so, as in segregate yourself off. Don't go join wisdom. Don't be wise. Be folly. Join the woman of folly. Eat with her. Drink with her. So this metaphor is contrasting these two, right? And in the woman of wisdom's case, she specifically instructs them, eat and drink. Be merry. There's a way to do this well, essentially. There's a passage parallel to this in Isaiah that talks about the future feast, which I didn't have us look up, and now that I'm sitting here, I don't know why I didn't have us look this up, but future feast of the church when we will be eating and drinking with Christ, and it says that we will drink wine with Christ in the new kingdom. 1 Timothy 3, 1 through 3.
It is true that anyone who desires to be a church official wants to be something worthwhile. That's why officials must have a good reputation and be faithful in marriage. They must be self-controlled, sensible, well-behaved, friendly to strangers, and able to teach. They must not be heavy drinkers or troublemakers. Instead, they must be kind and gentle and not love money.
So yeah, this is the qualifications for elders, right? Elders and the deacons come right after that and give similar instructions. But one of the instructions, if you want to be an elder, a church official, can be a heavy drinker of wine. I think my translation would say given too much wine. So you can't get drunk, that's what he's saying. 1 Corinthians 6, 9 through 11.
Do you not know that the wicked will not inherit the kingdom of God? Do not be deceived. Neither the sexually immoral, nor idolaters, nor adulterers, nor male prostitutes, nor homosexual offenders, nor thieves, nor the greedy, nor drunkards, nor slanderers, nor swindlers will inherit the kingdom of God. And that is what some of you were. But you were washed, you were sanctified, you were justified in the name of the Lord Jesus Christ and by the Spirit of our God.
Love that passage. Always got to remember verse 11 in there. This is one of the lists of Paul's sins. Paul lists sins in a couple different places. 1 Corinthians 6 is one of them. In this list of sins, it's a famous homosexuality passage because homosexuality is inside that list. But another thing on that list is drunkenness. The drunkards will not inherit the kingdom of God. He does this in a couple places. Galatians 5, right before he lists the fruit of the Spirit, he lists the deeds of the flesh. Right? Drunkenness is one of the things in those lists. Romans 13, he does the same thing. 1 Thessalonians, he does the same thing. He does it all over the place. He just says, don't you know that these things are evil? And then he'll list some stuff. And drunkenness is one of the things that is commonly on one of those lists. Things to avoid. Everybody track. Those are all the instruction passages where the Bible is prescribing some sort of behavior. What seems to be the prescribed behavior with alcohol?
Don't get drunk.
Don't get drunk. Yeah.
Because it's bad.
Drunkenness, if we were to refer back to our drugs thing, drunkenness takes you out of sober-mindedness, self-control. So, our systematic theology. Here's two things that I glean from these passages. So, this is my way of putting these passages together. Right? We take the pieces, put them together in a full puzzle picture. First of all, what's going on?
I'll picture Connor, first birthday, got a plane ride. The face he's making.
Why?
Is that today?
Yeah, it is.
Oh, well, happy birthday.
Like right now?
Yeah.
No, Connor, that's Cameron.
No, I know. I saw him earlier. Like, is he not here?
No.
Oh, that's awkward.
Are we back?
Yeah.
No.
That was just my plane.
He owns the plane. So...
That's cool. Just let me know what you back on earth. So systematic theology. How do we put these pieces together that we've seen from the Bible? We already kind of got one rule, the don't get drunk thing.
We use Stephen's four rules for drinking.
Yeah. Not yet. Start with our systematic theology, okay? First of all, watch the logic of this. Because Jesus came eating and drinking alcohol, and Jesus is God in flesh, and God cannot sin. So you see how we brought our theology into that. God can't sin. because Jesus drank alcohol and is God, merely ingesting alcohol cannot be innately sinful. We can't say that drinking alcohol, period, is sinful, period. You with me?
Mm-hmm.
However, we also see myriad warnings and direct classifications of drunkenness as expressly sinful. Paul's listing sins, he lists drunkenness in the midst of those sins. So, we would also conclude that getting drunk from alcohol is sinful. There's something in between, we have to say. Drinking alcohol itself is not sinful, but drunkenness is. So, balance is required. And so what I did was I sat down and I came up with four rules of when it might be wrong to drink or when it might be right to drink alcohol. First of all, for everybody in here, we go back to Romans 13, which says, be subject to the governing authorities, and the governing authorities say, drinking age 21. And so, for everybody here, except for me, I think, it's illegal, therefore sinful, for you to drink alcohol. However, once you reach the age of 21, or if the government were to say, okay, we're going to make the drinking age 18, which I think it should be.
Why?
I think it's silly that somebody can enlist but can't have a drink.
Wait, what do you mean?
Well, see, the reason they did it is because that when you're 21, you can also get a handgun permit. So, you know, they would rather have...
I think 21 for the handgun permit is a stupid age, too. But
well, they would rather have drunk people shooting other people...
than drunk people driving.
Right.
Which, the logic is not there.
Anyway, that aside, the reality is that the drinking age is 21. So,
Nowadays people don't really listen to the rules necessarily. So even if you have it at 18, at least you're not breaking the law.
What do you mean?
What if you have the legal drinking age changed to 18? People won't be breaking the law necessarily.
But
19-year-olds who are drinking won't be breaking the law when they drink, because the idea is they're going to do it anyway. Which is a bad argument,
but
by
at least
the way.
They wouldn't be breaking the law.
Yeah,
I know it's a bad.
The idea that because they're doing it anyway, we should change the law to match the behavior is a terrible argument.
And you
but
can't say
there are other reasons why I think that it should be changed to 18.
Okay,
and
I agree. At least then it wouldn't be illegal. But
and I think the problem with thinking that you would be able to do it, because I've known people that are like, oh well, I don't get drunk, I don't do that, just you know have the occasional beer or something. I'm like, well, that doesn't make any sense. All right, and then they'll say, because all you know, I'm always in the right mind. I make sure if I go to a party, I won't like drive myself home or something. I'll call a cab or however you do it here in Texas. I don't know, but yeah, that.
Well, technically,
and,
continue.
Yeah, and so I was thinking, I was like, well, even then, like it wouldn't really make any sense because you are putting yourself in a place of not sober mindedness.
Unsober mindedness.
Because like, doesn't he tell us like something like I'm trying to think of the word. But it's like not doing something that will cause you to sin, and that
would not cause your brother to stumble.
Yeah, it can potentially cause you to sin.
Yeah.
So I feel like it's kind of overlapping.
Correct. There's a balance. So here, let me walk you through my rules and then but to clarify, again, legality does not determine morality. Just because it's legal to get drunk at 21 does not mean it's right for Christians to get drunk once they're 21.
Isn't it also legal for, like, if your parents let you drink alcohol, then you can?
Yes.
Yeah.
Regardless of what the law says about what you can do, sometimes it's your job to limit yourself further than what the law says. As a Christian. Yeah. As a Christian who's following the Bible. That's the point I'm getting at. For Christians who are following the Bible, first of all, if you're over the age of 21, all of these apply. If you're under the age of 21, your responsibility as a Christian is not to drink because it is against the law, and you're supposed to be subject to the governing authorities. Unless it is legal in the situation where your parent allows you to drink in their presence. But if you are legally partaking of alcohol, these are the rules that Christians should follow. First of all, you can drink but don't get drunk. Pretty darn clear. From the Bible, that drunkenness is a sin. So you need to know your own body, you need to know your own metabolism, and you need to know when you cross over from drinking alcohol to being drunk on alcohol. I myself can have 1.5 beers per hour before I get drunk. If I have more than that, I start crossing the line. I've never actually been drunk, so I don't know what it's like to be drunk. But
well, how would you know?
Because and it's
when
hard
to stop.
Know yourself.
Stop, but like, wouldn't you have to first?
Well, if you start feeling like, but if you start feeling like you're, like, okay, this is probably it. If I go more than this, then I'm going to start getting.
And that's what I. Speaking from experience of drinking alcohol, you notice there's certain clues. You can feel kind of your tongue will start to get a little bit loose. You might start to feel slight dizziness. And these are not signs of drunkenness. These are signs that you're about to enter into drunkenness. Mm. Put it that way.
Like Legolas and was it Gimli and Lord of the Rings? Are they drinking contest?
Yeah. there are other things, though, when you might be required as a Christian to limit yourself in your alcohol consumption. Don't drink if you can't stop drinking. If you know that you are prone to abuse of alcohol, which I know lots of people who are prone to abuse of alcohol, they can't go and have just one beer per hour, like I limit myself to. They have to have 3 or 4. They just get caught up in the moment. They're out having a good time, and they start drinking, and they can't stop. If you know that about yourself, don't drink. Don't even have one if you can't stop at one. Mm-hmm. Make sense? So it might be your duty as a Christian to not drink at all, completely abstain, because you know yourself. You know that you can't do rule number one, so you got to do rule number two. Don't drink if your friends can't stop drinking. So if you're out with your friends and you're all legally consenting adults to drink alcohol as Christians, but you know that your friends can't follow rule number two or rule number one, you should abstain as an example and as an encouragement to your friend. You should say to your Christian friend who you know that he can't stop drinking, you should say, you know what, we just shouldn't drink it all tonight. Let's stick with Coke. Coca-Cola.
Let's just smoke instead. That's just the best.
Coca-Cola.
Right here. Yeah.
Get the paper out.
But yeah, and that is what plays into the don't cause your brother to stumble. I become all things to all men who by all means might save some. Paul talks about this when he talks about not eating meat sacrificed to idols. Right? In his context, that was the thing that it caused his brothers to stumble when he ate meat sacrificed to idols around them. Even though he knows it's not wrong, he's going to not do it for their sake because it could cause them to have poor spiritual effects. And then finally, don't drink for the wrong reasons.
Don't drink to feel happy.
Exactly. Don't use it as a drug to alter your state of mind. If you're drinking in order to enjoy a pleasure that God has created, as in the woman of wisdom in chapter 9 of Proverbs, if you're drinking to enjoy the merriment of Christian fellowship, and no one is getting drunk because of it, and it's an actual right pleasure, that would be a right reason to drink. If you're drinking alone by yourself to ease the pain of the day, or you've had a long day watching your little brother or sister, and you just are about to scream, so you have to have a glass of wine to calm your nerves, that is a wrong reason to drink.
Just go to sleep.
See, if you tie or duct tape your brother or sister to the wall, then, you know, you don't have that.
These are all, though, these are all kind of future things for you guys because it's not legal for any of you to drink yet. So when you get to the age of 21 and you start drinking. So, but as a personal testimony, as someone who legally partakes of alcohol on occasion, I'm over the age of 21. I didn't drink alcohol until I got to my 21st birthday, and I've never been drunk. There's an idea in our culture that you can't stop them from drinking, so we'll just bend the rules for them. And it gets talked about a lot about safe sex, encouraging people to use contraception. We can't stop them from having sex, so if you're going to have sex, use a condom. I think that's terrible pragmatism. It is not wrong to expect a higher level of moral behavior, particularly among Christians who have the Holy Spirit, who can be held accountable by brothers and sisters in Christ, who have the forgiveness of their sins. We should be able to demand of our brothers and sisters in Christ to hold themselves to a godly standard. And then also be there to forgive when that standard is not met, because we will all fall short of the glory of God.
Okay. Romans 6, something, 23, I think.
So that's alcohol. Now then, we got 15 minutes to cover war. Thankfully, it's a little bit shorter. We won't have to cover all of the biblical passages. So the biblical view of what war, on the other hand...
You said what it is good for.
This is like, you know, this works.
Oh, right.
Similar outline. We're going to look at a definition, then we're going to look at the biblical passages, then we're going to look at the question of killing versus murder, because that factors into the question of war. And then we'll look at a systematic theology of war. How do Christians view war? Definition, first of all. War. This is straight from Google. Google knows all the answers, right?
Where did you find out the answers?
It's in Second Opinions, chapter 3. Thou shalt obey Google.
But only the first page. The second page is... Yeah. You're getting decimated.
Or, yeah, synonym.
A state of armed conflict between different nations or states or different groups within a nation-state. Nation or state. You guys know what war is, right?
Armed?
It's people fighting.
But then there's the Cold War.
Usually armed, yeah.
And soft.
So yeah, the Cold War is called the Cold War because there wasn't a war. It was averted prior to.
Like the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm thinking of the Cuban Missile Crisis, aren't I?
Huh?
The Cold War was just getting cold shoulders thrown at each other. And like, I don't like you either. I'm going to build a wall.
I have nukes.
Ronald Reagan came in and said, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall. And here's some facts about war that Christians should recognize. First of all, war involves killing. If it doesn't involve killing, it's not war. Death, pain, anger, disagreement are all involved in war. And most of these would be things that we would assume are less than God's best. Put it that way. They are not inside the perfect will of God. They are within the permissible will of God. These are things that we would rather not have to deal with, but because of Genesis 3, we do. You with me?
Mm-hmm.
With that in mind, what about truth?
What?
Huh? What about truth? How is truth involved in war?
Because,
one, I guess, will sort of have a right view of why they're fighting, and then another one's just fighting because they disagree with what the other person is saying.
Yeah, I'd agree. Yes. I would think that truth is usually involved in war. One side in a conflict is usually more right than the other side. They might not be perfectly right, but they're closer to the truth than the other.
Unless they're like fighting over land.
I think even then.
How?
An example would be God promised Abraham, I will give you this land.
Oh, right.
And so Joshua was right in going in and waging
war to take it. And nowadays,
there's not really fighting over land.
No, there is. The exact same land.
Israel.
Between the same people, yeah. Israel and Palestine. The whole Palestinian conflict. Every time you see something about Israel and Gaza Strip and all that, it goes right back to Genesis 15.
Because it doesn't work like that.
Yeah, but people don't do that.
But the question of truth...
I'll share with you if you share with me.
Okay, but I want more.
Truth plays a part. And what we believe about truth is going to affect how we view war. Right? If there is an objective right, then one side, whichever one is fighting for that objective right, is correct in its defense of that right. With me? There's a way to... What I'm getting at is war is not necessarily always wrong. This is what we're going to see in a couple places. We're not going to read all of these, but somebody want to look up Ecclesiastes 3. We will read that one. And somebody want to read...
Ecclesiastes 3 and 8.
Matthew 24, I didn't put the verse down. We won't bother. Matthew 24 essentially says Jesus is talking about the end times, and he says there's going to be war.
Is his name still Siri if it's a man?
Yeah.
I think Siri's an
actor. No, it's Iris if it's a girl.
Somebody want to look up Romans 12:18?
No, it's Siri's the girl.
Well, Siri spoke that.
Steven.
Aggressive conversation.
And so you got Romans 12:18.
Mm-hmm. Siri spoke that.
Somebody else got Revelation 12.
Iris is the guy?
7 through 11.
Idris is the guy's
name.
My name is Iris.
So,
are you saying Romans a guy?
I feel like
you're
a
guy.
If she's not a guy.
Jonathan, got Revelation.
Okay. Wait, who has the Ecclesiastes 3:8?
You do.
Me? Alright, a time to live.
Okay, shh. Josh, go ahead. Ecclesiastes 3:8.
Alright. A time to love and a time to hate, a time for war,
is this a song?
And a time for peace. No,
yeah.
It doesn't
so you know that song? For every season, turn.
No.
There is a...
Oh, yeah.
A time for love, a time for love,
so that was
a time for love. Yeah, so that comes from Ecclesiastes 3.
Oh.
A time to tune. I don't know the lyrics as well. You know, so yeah, straight out of Ecclesiastes 3. But Solomon's wisdom at this point, he's saying that for everything there is a season. There are things that are going to go on in life. This is a reality of the world we live in. There's a time for love and a time for hate, a time for war and a time for peace. He's saying, all of these things are going to happen. Who had Deuteronomy 20? I think you did, Josh.
I thought I had...
Oh, you had Romans 12. That's right. Go ahead and read Romans 12.
Yeah, too.
Yeah, you should definitely.
If possible, so far as it depends on you, live peaceably with all.
So yeah, Paul is giving... This is when he's transferred into the instruction section of Romans. He's saying, now that I've given you all of this theological truth, here's how to apply it. And one of the things he says is, as far as it is possible, be at peace with all. So avoid conflict, is what he's saying. However, he recognizes in his statement, that's not always going to be possible. That's why he says that at the beginning. As far as it is possible, be at peace with all. What were you going to say?
Because, like, you know how we're saying, like, we shouldn't move the law because, like, people are going to do it?
Correct.
Like, I don't know.
We shouldn't move the law?
You shouldn't, like, change the drinking age to 18 just because kids are going to drink anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Like...
Yeah, you should have better arguments than that.
True, but that's just where I'm... You know where I'm going.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
But isn't that an indication of a bad law?
Not necessarily.
Like, the law is not very well...
Wait, how does this apply?
Wait, is it
a good
like,
law would be one that lines up with God's law. A bad law would be one that doesn't. So, yeah, just because the government says that homosexuals are legally recognized in marriages now, God's law says something different. And so that's a bad law, even though it's legal.
So it's a law, it's just not a good way.
It's just not a good law.
I mean,
again,
I'm
going to stress, legality does not equate to morality.
Okay.
Just because it's legal doesn't mean it's good, and just because it's illegal doesn't mean it's wrong. Those can factor into the question of how you should behave, but those are not the end-all, be-all. Legality doesn't answer the question all the time. God's law, God's legality does. Revelation 12, especially verses 7 through 11. The Revelation 12 is the, if you remember back when we studied Revelation, it's the woman and the dragon. And it's this, essentially this metaphor going on describing what's happening in heaven with the devil and the angels. So go ahead, 7 through 11.
7 through 11?
Yeah.
Okay. And there was a war in heaven. Michael and his angels fought against the dragon, and the dragon fought against his angels. Or the dragon fought, and his angels prevailed not, neither was their place found any more in heaven. And the great dragon was cast out, that old serpent called the devil and Satan, which deceiveth the whole world. And he was cast out into the earth, and his angels were cast out with him. And I heard a loud voice saying in heaven, now has come salvation and strength, and the kingdom of our God, and the power of his Christ. For the accuser of our brethren is cast down, which accused them before our God day and night. And they overcame him by the blood of the Lamb, and by the word of their testimony. And they loved not their lives unto the death.
They loved not their lives even unto death. So what's the point of that? First of all, you see war in heaven in the end times. Even in heaven, God's dwelling place, the reality of Satan's fall has brought war into the picture. Michael is fighting with the devil, and they've got angels on either side, and they're at war with each other. And Michael eventually wins, casts them out. And we see people who are dying, giving their lives in this armed conflict. We've got Joshua and Judges, and really almost all of the Old Testament from Joshua onward. War is kind of an underlying reality. There's, first of all, Joshua in this holy war. Joshua gets ready. He goes in and takes the land, and God instructs him, go in, kill everyone, kill everything, take the land, and set up shop. God specifically tells Joshua to do that. What makes it okay? What makes it right? The same thing that makes anything okay and right, because God said so. His rule, he's the one who makes the rules. So that's the short answer to that question. There's a longer, more involved answer to make it more palatable. But the short answer is, God told Joshua, go in and wage war and kill everything and take the land. So he does. And that is a just war. It is good for Joshua to do that. The book of Judges, every single time a judge rises up, the whole point of the judge rising up is to wage war against the oppressors and free Israel again, so that they would have control of the land and could follow God. And then they don't. They go back to following the idols, the Baals and the Ashtaroths. But the point is, God is the one who instigates this uprising, this war, in order to allow the people freedom to follow him. The prophets and the kings. Throughout all of these stories, we see God causing nations to come in and judge Israel, wage war on them, especially Habakkuk. We've talked about Habakkuk a couple times. The whole book of Habakkuk is him saying, when are you going to come down and fix what is wrong here in Israel? Don't you see all this wickedness going on? And God says, yeah, I'm going to send the Babylonians, and they're going to kill everybody. They're going to wage war on you. And God says, and I'm the one causing it to happen. And the righteous, they'll live by faith. They'll be resurrected in the end times.
Wait, but why?
Josiah, he's remembered as this great king. He died on the battlefield in honor.
Josiah
in the middle of a war.
One, right?
Yeah, he became king when he was 8. Yeah. So, again, those are descriptive texts. Stating the reality. That war exists. God seems to approve war in many cases, and he seems to judge wars in many cases. What depends on is which side are you on in the war? Are you on God's side, or are you on a different one? It's not quite so cut and dry, as Christians are against war. However, we've also got those verses, Romans 12, 2 Timothy is another one, that essentially says, be at peace with everyone as much as it is possible.
Should we be against modern war?
That's what we're trying to answer. Hopefully we'll have a clear answer to that question by the end of this. It's already 5 o'clock. We got to trek through. We don't have time for this. I would love to. Essentially, there's this verse that lots of people say. This makes it clear that Christians shouldn't participate in war. Thou shalt not kill. One of the Ten Commandments. Actually, what the commandment says is thou shalt not murder. There's a clear distinction in both the Hebrew and the Greek. In Hebrew, there's a different word for murder than for kill. One means causing the end of a life, another human life. And one means I'm going to specifically maliciously end this other human life for selfish reasons, usually. Murder is wrong. Killing is not necessarily wrong. Sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't. So that's the short version. You can look through these slides later if you'd like. But in the original verse, it says, thou shalt not murder. It does not say, thou shalt not kill. And when Jesus quotes the verse, he says, thou shalt not murder, instead of thou shalt not kill. So the point is, the moral code says you shall not maliciously take another human life. It does not say you should never take a human life. And the distinction is important because of the C.S. Lewis quote that I'm about to share with you. Question.
What about, let's say there's a cop, and there's somebody who pulled a gun, and he or she shoots him. Would that be technically murder?
I think that would, in many cases, would be kill, not murder.
Wait,
in order to preserve your own life.
Are you saying the person in the car has a gun?
Yeah, the person on the car pulls a cop on the gun.
So, yeah,
the person
is it okay for a cop to kill someone in the line of duty? I think it is okay for a cop to kill someone in the line of duty. And
so if they like pull a stapler on, they think it's a gun. They're allowed to shoot.
Yeah. Well,
plausible denial.
Like in Batman, he's got the stapler.
No. Well, they're allowed to.
Like to what?
They think it's a gun.
Technically, they're allowed.
Yes, I would. I would say yeah. If they perceive it's a threat, it is permissible for them to.
I feel like it's only murder, and
that's what I'm saying. It's a tricky situation because it could be just that they're stupid and it's obvious that it's not a threat and they're just wrong. But it might be that the circumstances of the situation means it's justifiable. And we see examples of this all throughout the Old Testament. God actually gives Moses specific laws about when somebody dies in this way, when somebody kills somebody in this way. This one is wrong and this one isn't. And usually the difference is, was there some kind of accident involved? Was there some kind of malicious planning intent involved? And that's how you determine the difference. The C.S. Lewis quote sums it up nicely from your Christianity. All killing is not murder any more than all sexual immorality, and all sexual intercourse is adultery. When soldiers came to St. John the Baptist asking what to do, he never remotely suggested that they ought to leave the army. Nor did Christ when he met a Roman sergeant major, what they call a centurion. The idea of the knight, the Christian in arms for the defense of a good cause, is one of the great Christian ideas. War is a dreadful thing, and I can respect an honest pacifist, though I think he is entirely mistaken. We may punish if necessary, but we must not enjoy it. It is hard work, but the attempt is not impossible. Even while we kill and punish, we must try to feel about the enemy as we feel about ourselves. To wish that he or she were not bad. To hope that he may, in this world or another, be cured. In fact, to wish his good. That is what is meant in the Bible by loving him. Wishing him good, not feeling fond of him, nor saying he is nice when he isn't. This is when he's trying to deal with the question of how do we love our neighbor as ourselves. He says, I don't even like myself. So it doesn't mean I have to like my neighbor to love him. But I love myself, even though I don't like myself often, because I'm a sinner. So he's trying to wrestle with this question of how do we love our neighbor as ourselves. And he also talks about killing. It's a really good quote and a good chapter. It's a great book. So, briefly, what is our systematic theology on this? First of all, war is the temporary reality. It became possible at the fall, and it will remain possible until the new earth. In Revelation, at the end of the book, one that we didn't read, it says, pain and death, there will be no more tears, we will wipe away all tears, there will be no more death or pain in the new earth, which means there can't be any war left.
Does it also specifically say that there will be no war?
I'm not positive it might. Can you look it up? It's chapter 21. However, in our systematic theology, we also recognize God has instructed wars to occur. He has specifically caused wars to happen, which means that some wars are justified. Some wars are right to wage. War exists or will exist in heaven. We saw that in Revelation chapter 12 with Satan and the angel Michael duking it out. What is the Christian view then? Christians are to avoid war if possible. As long as it depends on yourself, be at peace with all those around you. However, they are to courageously engage when peace is impossible. I do think it is a Christian duty to fight for a good cause. Say, love of country or defense of Israel. If it were to come to a point where I had the opportunity to defend Israel, I believe that Christians should do that because it is God's chosen land. He's given it to those people, and it will be to his new kingdom in the millennial kingdom. So it would be on the right side to defend that land for the people of Israel. So, I agree with Lewis when he mentioned war is a dreadful thing, and I can respect an honest pacifist, but I think he is entirely mistaken. I can respect... I can respect an honest pacifist. I mean, somebody who says I'm going to not engage in war because I just don't like the idea of all of this killing, death. It seems wrong to me. I can respect him for that. I still think he's wrong. I think that there are some wars, there are some things that have to be fought, and the proper Christian response is courage. It's a virtue. It's in the face of death, defending what is good and shunning what is evil.
So it's not like, so basically, like, if you have to be in a war, or like, don't, I don't know how to phrase it, don't avoid war because you're afraid of war. Avoid war, you know, if possible, like.
Correct.
Yeah.
Peace is preferable to war, but the reality until the new earth is that wars will exist because of the fall. And so as far as you are able, stop wars from occurring. But when they occur and you are on the good side, fight for what is good. Defend what is good and shun what is evil. The same way that we are at war with ourselves, Paul instructs us. Kill what is fleshly inside of you. Wage war against it. We wrestle not with flesh and blood, but with principalities, powers, powers of darkness. And then he tells you, put on the armor of God, suit up for battle. Fighting for what is right is a good thing. And in our postmodern culture that says the prime objective is never to offend someone, we get that mixed up. Offending people is quite often a good thing when you're offending them for the right reasons. What are the right reasons? The right reasons are what God says are the right reasons. And we covered that with morality. That's why I started this whole thing about what is truth and what is morality. Because what you think about those is going to determine how you sort through all of these. It's whether or not this says it's true or not, then that's what you fight for.
So, like, with, like, war nowadays, like, so avoiding war, like, talking about, like, avoiding war, if someone were to go, like, enlist in the army or, you know, whatever, mm-hmm. would that be, like, what would that be?
I would say, so the avoiding war thing is saying, if you're in the position to where you can stop war from occurring.
Okay.
So, like, say, in our context, and if we're talking about an American war, if you're in a position of government to where you could solve the dispute prior to war occurring, then you should do so as a Christian. In more of the social context, if you're in a situation where you could stop a fight from happening, then you should do so. However, if a fight is to break out, you should be fighting for what is good. So, like, say, somebody's bullying somebody else, and you can step in and fight on behalf of the person who's being bullied. You should do so. It is right to fight to protect the innocent. Put quotes around that.
Stephen told me I could.
Yeah.
So,
how'd
you get into murder, them? Stephen, like, the right reason. Like, with that still.
I would say it's not murder.
Stephen told me to.
Wait, where'd you say it?
He's there. So,
what if you, like, murder them, but for, like, the right reason?
I would say there's that's a contradiction of terms. Yeah. And that's why I wish we could have spent more time on the whole difference between killing and murder. But you can go read the slides later.
Yeah, because I mean, I feel like if you see, like, I don't know. I feel like if you're in the point where you're, like, traumatized or something, and, like, what do you do? Do you just, like, not? Like, let's say, I hate how, no, let's not use Batman. No, I was thinking, like, if Bruce Wayne was older and he had, like, well, the dude had a gun anyway, so that wouldn't even work. But, like, let's say you see someone hurting a family member and they end up killing them, and you have the means to stop them, but you end up killing them in the process.
Killing who?
The person that killed your person.
Oh, yeah.
Is that, like...
I would say, biblically, that is justifiable.
That's what I'm thinking.
So revenge killing could...
We're talking about in the moment, right?
Yeah, in the moment. Yeah.
In
not
defense.
Tracking someone down because...
Yeah, not...
That's murder.
Yeah. That's murder.
That would go against the biblical principle, do not avenge the death of others. For
yeah, right.
God says,
let God.
Vengeance is mine. Yeah. So, in the moment, if you have the opportunity to prevent evil from occurring, and in so doing, you have to take another life, it is not necessarily wrong. However, after evil has occurred, and you want to go and take a life then it crosses into murder, right? Then it's wrong. You should see the distinction.
Yeah. What about the death penalty?
I think we're going to cover that.
Yeah, that's covered in another.
On another lesson, we're specifically going to talk about capital punishment. I think it is Nathan who's covering it. It might be me.
I really wanted to do it.
If you want to, you can.
I mean, if he's not here.
I got to look at what the schedule is. I thought Nathan was just doing euthanasia, but he might be doing both euthanasia.
I think he did say.
I think he's only doing one. Someone else is doing death penalty.
We can check, and if you want to do it, you can.
Death penalty.
Zach.
As far as I know, the only two people who are teaching other than me are Clint and Nathan, but. But we can talk about that later. We're way over time. Yeah, war is actually a pretty complicated subject for Christians. It's not nearly cut and dry as you would think. There's also a really great section of Mr. Christianity that I had to cut out just for slide space. But he supposes when he was fighting in World War I, and he imagines, what if I and a German soldier were to kill each other at the same time? And we were together in the afterlife for a brief moment. I would think that we would have a laugh about it.
Hey, I killed you at the same time.
Yeah, it's a great book.
I could see that happening.
But yeah, the point is, they're both fighting for what they perceive as right. They're being subject to the governing authority. Like in that case, neither one would be wrong for killing each other. They might be wrong for other things, but the act of killing each other wouldn't be highest on the list. Put it that way.
I don't like how you phrase that.
Okay, don't worry about it then. My goal with this was not necessarily to answer every single question on war, because it's so complex and there's so many situations that you'd have to work through, but to give you some general principles and to make you question kind of your basic presuppositions, because thinking through things, biblically speaking, there are times when it is justified and right to fight and even to kill.
So
the question is when.
So what if you think about enlisting? Like, would enlisting be wrong?
I would think that enlisting is correct.
I almost did.
I'd say that is practicing one of the virtues, courage.
But what if you, like, enlisted for the wrong reason?
Well, yeah.
What if the war?
Yeah, like, then you might be wrong to enlist.
Now, what if the war itself is like?
I would say that if they were to reinstitute the draft, the Christian thing to do is to go and enlist,
right?
And definitely not to dodge your draft. You should fight.
But when more like now, if you were to go enlist, like. What would be your point of view on that?
Defense of country, I think, is a... I think that there's a place within the Christian worldview for patriotism and defense of country.
You mean since we're not, like, currently...
Are we still in a war?
I don't know what it is.
There's armed conflict going on, but we're not in a war.
Yeah, it's not like World War I or II or Vietnam or anything like that, but it's...
But yes, there are soldiers overseas fighting and dying currently. All right, we're way over time, so we'll call it.
Wait, how way over?